The Medicaid rolls in Arizona are growing faster than anyone predicted. Right now, one in five people in the state depend on the health care program that was created to serve the poor and disabled. Lawmakers in Washington are talking about expanding Medicaid as part of a health care overhaul. But Arizona's having trouble paying for the program at its current level, and policymakers say they can't afford to cover more people. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
Nationally, about a third of Medicaid dollars go toward nursing home care, but the growth of the program in Arizona is primarily due to the economy. 22-year-old Yanni Rodriguez is a single mother of two. She recently signed up for the state's Medicaid program. Rodriguez worries she may be suffering from the same cervical cancer that killed two of her aunts.
They both died. They both went through chemo, and they didn't make it. And maybe for the past 2 months, I started feeling my leg real weird.
Rodriguez says a doctor warned her that a medical test a year and a half back didn't look quite right. At the time, she was pregnant and planned to follow up later, but then with the new baby, time just got away from her.
It's been the 9 months of his pregnancy, and now he's 8 months, and I was really concerned of how long it's been and how much it could have been in advance.
Rodriguez says she's ready to get care now, and she's thankful Medicaid exists. Stories like hers are familiar to Tony Rogers. He's the director of the state's Medicaid program. It's called the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. Most folks use the acronym ACCESS.
I would say in a normal year, we might see 60,000 additional members. Well, we're probably going to see close to 300,000 additional members by the end of the year.
Rogers says that's a crisis for Arizona. Tax revenue is down since the state depends on the slumping construction and service industries. Medicaid costs are going up, and at the same time, Rogers' agency had to lay off 70 employees.
This is kind of a financial tsunami for us, and we're just trying to hold on to any log that's rolling along and trying to save ourselves to the wave stops.
The Medicaid problem has contributed to a budget standoff between Republican Governor Jan Brewer and the GOP-controlled state legislature. The governor wants a 1% sales tax increase, but legislative leaders say they don't have the votes for that. Lawmakers are concerned about more than just money. State Representative Nancy Bartow says she's uncomfortable with the large role Medicaid already plays in the healthcare business.
We have currently over 1 out of 5 persons in Arizona on ACCESS. That to me says right now government's already doing too much.
Arizona was the last state in the union to embrace the Medicaid program. For more than 15 years, from the mid-60s until 1982, Arizona forfeited its share of federal Medicaid money rather than create a state program. That history has supporters of expanding Medicaid worried. Eddie Sissons is executive director of the Arizona Foundation for Behavioral Health. She says if Congress expands Medicaid and that requires Arizona to contribute more money,
we'd probably walk away. Right now, because of the state's fiscal crises, I think we could very easily just say, not now, we can't do that, and we'd have to wait for either a change in our economy and possibly even a change in the political environment in Arizona.
Even if the federal expansion of Medicaid includes extra money for strapped states, as most expect it will, fiscal conservatives in Arizona are skeptical. Their concern has helped revive a ballot measure that would try to block key parts of a health care overhaul in the state. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
In recent months, we've spoken with Michael Pollan, who wrote in his bestseller Omnivore's Dilemma that higher prices for groceries might, quote, level the playing field for sustainable food that doesn't rely on fossil fuels. We also talked with Alan Ruppelschell, the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Today, the Los Angeles Times published an op-ed by Charlotte Allen, who describes them and others as self-righteous social critics who want us to pay more for food, gas, furniture, and clothes. Eat all the plants you like, she writes to Michael Pollan fans, but don't try to pry me from my Haagen-Dazs dark chocolate ice cream. I bought it at Safeway, and it's sitting on my IKEA kitchen table. Well, if you've read the critics, if you buy food, gas, furniture, and clothes, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Charlotte Allen is kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And you write that demanding that other people impoverish themselves, especially these days, in the name of your pet cause, well, it goes way beyond Marie Antoinette. The self-righteousness, aren't these people just trying to find a better way?
Well, Well, sure they are, but the things that they tell people to find a better way are basically impossible given what most people have, for example, to spend on food. We have Alice Waters, for example, crusading that everyone should buy all their food at farmers markets. You shouldn't buy food that's grown more than 100 miles away, which is great for Californians where everything grows everywhere. Not so great if you live on the East Coast, as I do. You go to a farmer's market. I found some prices, for example, at the one closest to my home. You'll pay, for example, $4 a pound for tomatoes, $2.49 at the Safeway. You'll pay an outrageous $6 for a half pint of artisanal gelato. That was advertised. That's $6 for a cup of ice cream, barely enough to feed two people.
I think I decoded the word artisanal. It means a 50% extra.
Yes, it does. I think that's exactly what it means. And what's happened, I mean, it's sort of crazy. Back, say, in the old days, there have always been farmers markets, farm stands, roadside stands where farmers have sold their produce. And it's usually actually been cheaper than what you can get at the supermarket and better tasting. Now you've got all these artisanal, sustainable farms. I call them art farms. They're little boutique farms that grow very expensive stuff. They have eco-conscious green names, like they'll have a name like Eco Acres or Sustainable Hills. And they'll have some special dairy product or whatever. And they're just way out of the price range. They're great. The food's really, really good. But it's stuff that most people can't afford. What's unfortunate is that we live in a country with just a plethora of affordable food. Go to the Safeway and good quality beef for not too much money.
And this is something that you seem to you're very funny about it in your piece, and it's good, but I almost resent the fact that these people want you to pay more when you could pay less.
When you could and can pay less, especially since we've got a recession going on, the worst recession since the Great Depression. You've also got ordinary food prices going up because of fuel prices last year. And to ask people who are already trying to stretch their food dollars to say, go without an extra pair of Nike sneakers or go without a cell phone, which is what Alice Waters told the New York Times, it just seems absurd.
Other people, though, say in terms of Ellen Ruppel Shell, one of the things she was talking about is all of these cheap products come from places, manufactured, many of them in China, where workers are exploited. They cut corners and in terms of environmental effects, and, of course, they cut corners in terms of quality.
Yeah, China does have serious environmental problems, but those are China's problems, and they're not our problems. And unfortunately, that's where most stuff is made, not just cheap stuff, but high-quality stuff. Cole Haan shoes, for example, are made in China now because the Chinese actually do have the capability of making good products. So it's not a question of everything from China being cheap, but it certainly is less expensive because their labor costs are less. People in America just won't work for the kind of wages they pay in China that make goods affordable here. They also provide jobs for Chinese people who 30 years ago were living on dirt-poor collective farms.
Many of them 30 days ago living on
right.
collective
yeah.
farms.
And they come to those cities. They flock to those cities for those jobs. Those jobs look really great to them compared to what they've grown up with.
We're talking with Charlotte Allen on the opinion page this week. She's the author of Keep Your Self-Righteous Fingers Off My Processed Food. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Thomas in on the conversation. Thomas with us from Grand Junction in Colorado.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Neil. I just wanted to say kudos to your speaker today. I really appreciate Cheese Whiz on my Philly cheesesteaks. And it's just, I have a garden at home, and I eat the vegetables out of my garden when I can, you know, have time to grow them. But, you know, there's nothing like a good processed cheese on a Philly cheesesteak. That's what
I did see a sign at a Philly cheesesteak stand on the Delmarva Peninsula that says, "We only use genuine Cheese Whiz."
Yeah, I'd love to see a sign in a restaurant that says, you know, our food isn't necessarily good for you, but it tastes well. Tastes good, you know?
Well, Thomas, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. And we mentioned Häagen-Dazs, but the ice cream taken out for attack, not because it comes from abroad or it's made in China, which it's not.
It's made right here. It's made from, in fact, the new five ingredients, Häagen-Dazs ice cream advertises that it's made with all natural ingredients, a very simple product. Ask Michael Pollan about it, and he'll say, no, no Häagen-Dazs for you because it's commercially made. He says his mantra now is, don't buy anything you've ever seen advertised. So it's basically not really a crusade for quality. I think it's a crusade for defining yourself as one of an elite that can afford this stuff, and then sort of trying to make other people conform.
Here's an email from Matt in Oakland. The argument isn't that you should be paying more for your food to promote elitism. The argument is that your current diet imposes costs on other people who are as poor or poorer than you are. For example, industrial farming has created a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's helped destroy fisheries that used to support hardworking people there. There's nothing elitist about asking you to bear the cost of that, or better yet, pay for fixing it.
Well, how do you propose doing that, since these are Mexican fishermen? They're not in the U.S. So what are we supposed to do about that?
Let's see if we get one more caller in, and let's go with Adam. Adam with us from Tucson.
Hi, I just wanted to say I heard your guest speaking about the high food prices at the farmers markets, and as a small farmer, I'd like to say that it's well worth paying that because it helps keep small farms alive in your area. We're about 22 miles from the Mexican border here, and there's a lot of the food is outsourced there to Mexico, where quality is an issue, wages, fair wages to people is an issue, and as a small farmer trying to make it, it's not cheap to produce that food, nor pay. If we try and have employees here and try and pay a living wage, that ends up being pretty costly also.
Does it gall you, Adam, when you see what you have to charge for, I don't know what it is you grow, green beans or whatever, strawberries maybe, I don't know what it is, but then you see what it costs you to grow that food, and then you see the prices in the local supermarket?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, food accessibility is a big, you know, is something that we want to create. But at this point, you know, we're doing what we can. I'm actually on food stamps myself because I can't earn enough money as a small farmer to make it at this point. So, and I do agree. I don't agree with the whole thing on the idea of it being everything local. I don't think that's possible. But I do think that it is voting with your dollar when you do that, and well worth it.
Adam, good luck to you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. And I'm sure you wish Adam well, too, but nevertheless.
Oh, of course. Yes. I mean, and if his strawberries are really good, people are going to buy them.
But in the other case, if they're a difference of, a dollar a quart, you might go to the Safeway.
That's right. You might. And, I mean, and in fact, the strawberries at the Safeway probably aren't going to be that great because they've been shipped from California. But if you don't have the money for boutique strawberries, why not have strawberries, period? They're pretty good. They're not so bad.
Charlotte Allen, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Charlotte Allen joined us here in Studio 3A. Her op-ed is called Keep Your Self-Righteous Fingers Off My Processed Food. It ran in yesterday's Los Angeles Times. There's a link to it at our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. She's also a contributing editor to the Minding the Campus website of the Manhattan Institute. Tomorrow, Tom Ridge joins us, the former Secretary for Homeland Security, plus Kim Masters on The Real Inglourious Bastard. I'm Neil Conan. Be with us then. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Want even more talk? Head over to our blog at npr.org. There you can weigh in on the topics that landed on the cutting room floor, get a look at what's piquing our interest, and tell us what's caught your attention. You'll find it at the new npr.org/blogofthenation.
When the Treasury began pouring money into troubled banks last year, many taxpayers were furious, fearing billions were going down the drain. But now some of that bailout money is coming back. To find out whether taxpayers are reaping good returns from the financial rescue, we turned to David Wessel. He's economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's start with $700 billion. That was the bailout, that money that ended up as infusions into banks. Is that turning out to have been a profitable investment?
Well, if you look only at the banks that have paid back the money, which is the stronger banks, we report in the Wall Street Journal this morning that a firm called SNL Financial estimates that 34 banks, big and small, have paid back $70 billion in TARP money, and the government has made a $5 billion profit on that, which works out to a 7% annual return at an annual rate, which isn't bad. But there are a lot of weak banks that haven't paid back the money, and there are a lot of guarantees that the government made that probably will have to, that people won't pay back the money. So we're getting the good news first, and we'll get the bad news later.
Well, if taxpayers do turn a profit, even in some cases, does that mean that the bailout is successful, or at least partially successful?
Well, it's making money is definitely better than losing money. But the point of all this was not to make money. The government isn't an investment manager. It was to save the financial system in order to save the U.S. economy from an even worse recession than we really had. So that's the big test. It's also important, I think, to remember that most of the banks got money from the government, from the taxpayers, at terms they could never have gotten it on the private market. So in that sense, there was a subsidy to these companies, even if we make some money on it.
Well, still, do these recent reports of profits and then hearing about banks actually paying back their bailout fund, does it make life easier for Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and also maybe Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke?
Oh, absolutely. Look, it's much better to make money than to lose money, and I'm sure they were very happy at the headlines this week about profits that were being made. But I think that this isn't going to remove all the anxiety about the bailout. People are very exercised about the amount of money that bankers are being paid, and that seems to get much more traction with the public than some complicated accounting about if you do the TARP money this way, we made money, and if you look at the guarantees another way, we didn't make money. But fundamentally, I think people want a strong economy, and if the economy turns out to be a strong and healthy in a few months, the bailout will look to have been a success. And if the economy is languishing, if unemployment remains at 10% for another year and a half, then they're going to judge the economy to have been, the bailout to have been a disaster.
And either of those two futures are possible?
Absolutely. Although the recent signs are that the economy here and abroad seems to be coming back somewhat better than a lot of people expected, including me.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
Competitors arrive at the Dutchess County Fair in Rhinebeck, New York, hoping to win blue ribbons for everything from goat milking prowess to prized heifers. And ever since the 1980s, women have been trying to demonstrate control over one especially unwieldy breed, their husbands. They did it again yesterday at the annual Husband Calling Contest. Lara Pellegrinelli checked it out at the Livestock Arena at the Dutchess County Fair.
Contrary to popular opinion these days, you don't need to be wired to stay connected with your loved ones. At the Dutchess County Fair, you'll never catch anyone asking, "Can you hear me now?"
John! Where are you?
The fair's annual husband calling contest brings communication between a woman and her man back to the basics. Inspired by hog-calling events at other country fairs, the contest was the brainchild of Andy Imperati.
The hogs could be a mile away, and they'll go, "Hee!" You know how they call hogs? And then hogs come running across the field. It's unbelievable. And then I thought, well, God, we don't have the hogs here. Maybe I'll just have to turn it into a husband calling contest, and it worked out perfect.
You heard him. In agrarian Dutchess County, they didn't have swine to call, so they found a ready substitute in their menfolk. So what kind of call does Imperati's wife of 47 years use to motivate him?
Well, I can't tell you what she says most of the time, right?
I need two more volunteers to be judges.
Imperati pulls audience members out of the stands to serve as judges. They evaluate contestants on loudness, clarity, and creativity. The reason Ernestine Martin dominated the competition for nearly a decade.
One of my calls was the one in which I said, "Bill, I just got a phone call from my doctor. We've killed another rabbit, sucker."
That call wasn't about a pet bunny, but kidded about the arrival of baby number 7. This year, Australian-born Margie Reardon scored points for her imaginative call, taking second place.
"Come here, you big stud! I'm waiting for you! Come on!" I've got some chicken! I've got some goat
Even though Reardon's husband almost hopped the fence to reach her, the winner was Donna Kuklis from Saugerties, New York. She won $40 and a blue ribbon. Might not be able to hear her, having weathered her calls for 11 years of marriage.
I can't hear you. I just can't hear anymore.
For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.